Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Fabianski holds Arsenal's hopes in his hands. Oh no, sorry, he's given them back to the referee. All the views on the Gunners' ropey defeat to Porto coming up. Wayne Rooney's half-time ball-out stirs United to victory. Speaking of ball-out, do you think that's what Ashley intended with those phone picks? And as Madrid are hit by a Macoongon attack, we'll be asking Dr. Sid where the painkillers are. All that, plus posts, a full weekend of Premiership action to preview, and the rare sight of a goose heading to Turkey. It could only be Football Weekly Extra. Yes, I'm Paul McInnes, and after some complained that all Monday's panellists sounded exactly the same, I'm pleased to say that today I'm joined by an Irishman, Paul Doyle.
Hi, Paul.
A Scotsman, Kevin McCarra.
Okay.
And an adenoidinal Englishman, oi. Rob Smythe. So we've got a lot to get talking about, so let's get cracking. And we'll start with last night's action at the Estadio Dragao. Paul Doyle.
I think what it all boils down to is, metaphorically speaking, Arsene Wenger needs to take his team to a brothel. Because
you're sure you're talking metaphorically?
strictly metaphorically. I think I mentioned before that earlier in the season, in a press conference, Arsene Wenger said that the big difference between his side this year and last year was their mental strength. Now, I asked him again about that just a few weeks ago, before the Chelsea game, because it seems to me that it's palpably untrue. I think of Abu Dhabi scoring a ridiculous own goal at Old Trafford, them freezing in the first half at Anfield, and whenever there's high stakes game, they tend to freeze. And after the home performance against Man United, Wenger himself admitted that they were naive in the way that they played during that game. So when I asked him about it again, he drew a distinction between mental weakness and mental immaturity, which I think is a valid distinction to make. And he said that his team aren't mentally weak, they're mentally immature, and that they do tend to freeze in big games and just let big games get away from them a bit. And he said, until they win one of these big games or get a trophy or a medal that they feel they deserve, they're going to remain in this psychological state of fluster.
So it's not a question of age. It's the fact that they haven't won anything means exactly. They're not going to win anything.
I mean, they're virginal, and they fumble or freeze as climax approaches. So they metaphorically need, I think, to visit a prostitute, the League Cup. Get a League Cup or the FA Cup.
And well, this is Rob's point that he was making on Monday. Kevin, I mean, do you think that he set the team out the right way last night?
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought Arsenal played well. And if you look at forgetting all the horrible mistakes, you'd think they're pretty well set up to go through. It was never going to be an easy against Porto, but you'd think they could handle this in the second leg. What I found most interesting in retrospect was Wenger talking up Fabianski before the game, what a talent he was. And now I think he reckons that Fabianski needed some encouragement to face up to this. There's a kind of displacement activity where Arsene Wenger's concerned. I mean, let's face it, it might not have been a pass back, but the referee doesn't know that. He's standing behind Saul Campbell and sees him kick the ball and naturally thinks it's a pass back. Fabianski, I don't think he's thinking about anything. I mean, if he'd actually thought, I mean, he's obviously just gone and had a mad moment and picked it up because still feeling the pressure of his earlier goal. So, I mean, I think in the end, we'll look upon this as an eccentricity when Arsenal go through. But one final thing I loved. Arsene Wenger demands an audience with the referee, it seems, after that goal. The referee has to explain himself. I thought, how many managers could guarantee that the referee would come over and explain themselves?
Well, if they invite him to a brothel, maybe.
Well, possibly. Well, obviously Fabio Capello, the referee would be scared not to. Alex Ferguson, similar grounds. Then again, you think like Rafael Benitez. I wouldn't risk it. You get sent to the stand.
You'd never escape if you're inviting around Rafa's house. Rob, again, you had your hand up.
Well, I was just going to say what was alarming about the second goal was not just that Fabianski was dithering and Sol Campbell decided to have an existential crisis.
That's harsh. I don't think that was Sol's fault
at all.
No,
it was just funny.
His reaction to the mistake.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
But also, for Marlon and Diaby were just sauntering back, whistling a happy song. It wasn't just that one person, it was just a collective I don't know, naivety at best. I don't know what it is, but it was bizarre that four different people of different kind of ages and experience made exactly the same mistake.
You were saying earlier about the attitude that Sol Campbell expressed. See what you're saying earlier? Oh, no, it was about the body language.
Kind of, look what I have to work with. look at this idiot of a referee, what he's done to me. He just looked like the whole world was going to collapse upon him.
And his teammates. I think he's thinking, yeah. When I was here first time around, it was very, very different.
Yeah, exactly. David Seaman.
Did the referee have to signal before he gives that free kick? Because he put his hand up after the ball was played. What's the protocol there?
No, I think a quick free kick can be given in the nod. I've seen it done many a time.
In Wenger's defence, Arsenal scored two of that nature in 2004, both by Omri. And both times he said, I don't really like this law. I think it needs clarification. So he's not quite being as much of a hypocrite as people would like to claim. Should say that.
I have here, amongst my statistics, a figure that says that Arsenal haven't overturned a first lead deficit since 1978-79, when they're playing Hajduk Split. On the other hand, the last time they played Porto at home, they scored four goals to Porto's nil, but two of them were scored by Van Persie and Adebayor. Kevin, you think they'll overturn? You'll think they'll be fine?
I do. I mean, I didn't think Bentner was brilliant last night, but I thought he gave them a physical presence in the middle of the attack that they've been missing since poor Arshavin, who's not cut out for it, has been playing there. I thought he had quite a good game last night, Bentner, and caused enough problems. I mean, at times, Porto were defending desperately on their own ground. So whether they've got the organisation to keep Arsenal at bay for 90 minutes or 2 hours, given that luxury the home team has in the second leg, I still think Arsenal are strong favourites to overturn this.
The sad thing about Campbell, actually, he did play really well for so much of the game. That tackle he made early on was brilliant. The goal, and then this one. And it wasn't really his fault, but it was just the kind of farce that seems to befall him. I don't know why I find it so funny.
Actually, I think Campbell did well.
Campbell's first half tackle was classic Campbell. When someone gets wrong side and he times it perfectly to get the foot round, it was brilliant.
Yeah, but you could see that yard of pace that had gone as well.
The fact
that
he needed to do that was indicative.
You think how few appearances he had, a trifle with Notts County for about 10 minutes and hardly played for Arsenal. I mean, is some going to play in the Champions League at all?
Speaking of trifle, it looks like he's been eating a bit as well in the shirt. But anyway, we'll move on to Manchester United, or should we say Rooney FC. Rob, you were minute-by-minuting.
Yeah.
Give us the big picture.
Having predicted a 0-0. I just think it's a kind of game that defies analysis. It was balmy. Some incredibly bad defending from both sides, but particularly United.
What do you think was it that turned it around?
A fluke goal. Nothing more or less than that. It could have been 3-0. United drew strength from the equaliser. And also there was a period in the second half when Milan's legs had clearly gone. And I think they were only then invigorated by getting a lucky second goal. Not lucky, but unexpected.
It was bringing just a game on their 35-year-old substitute.
Yeah, they're youthful 35-year-olds. It was just a game that swung so violently so often that I still can't really make any sense of it. One thing I would say is that Ronaldinho was an absolute joy. Some of his touches, he was very close to his best, and just to see him play like that was great. I don't think he had it in him.
True. So, Kevin, tell us, you were actually in the San Siro. You were hanging out with all the A-listers. tell us about Rooney. I mean, for me, I think he could well be the best English player of my lifetime. I mean, he really has everything.
I've always thought he was brilliant since that game against Everton when he was 16. Yeah. But I've got kind of mixed feelings. Obviously, what he's doing is the point of the game, to score goals. I mean, and you can't do any more than that. And his movement was very good. Although, God help us, poor old Alessandro Nesta showing his age by the end. I mean, I know he's been injured recently, but that really was a sad showing from a man who was meant to be the rock of the back four. But really, his movement was clever. The headers were good. I just sometimes wish I'd still like to see him contributing to build up and things like that. But when he's the only forward, who does he contribute to or with? I mean, he's
well, one thing that is really to his credit is the fact he's playing as a number 9 for his club and a number 10 for his country, and that takes a lot of adaptability. They're completely different roles.
But Capello was saying quite the opposite. He was saying, oh yes, this is what he's been doing for England. Well, he's been scoring goals for England, but not in the same way.
No,
coming onto the ball with Heskey ahead of him.
He's been the pivot for England, linking
by
anyway.
But you can't possibly say he shouldn't play there when he's causing havoc in the Champions League. But I just like to see the full range of Rooney's gifts, so I think you see that when he's got more freedom.
Agree.
But then Man U's hands are tied because Berbatov hasn't done it. So who else has he got to play at centre forward that's going to do it? Well, Mike alone. So I think it's a default setting. But Man U, I was writing this in the paper, Man U's an incredible club. I mean, there's all sorts of things wrong with the squad. And, and yet,
and
there they are, a point off the Premier League, they've beaten Milan. You know, it's I guess it's a kind of, some of them have it in their head that you do this because they've been there so long. And of course, Rooney's, you know, covering up for defects, but it's an extraordinary sight to behold that Man U are so close to the top of the Premier League and doing splendidly in the Champions League.
And you write in your piece there about rustiness coming back, but also Rio potentially being kind of labelled as over. I mean, obviously, we hacks rush to judgment on players quite a lot, but worrying signs for the summer?
Well, I mean, that was what, maybe his 10th appearance of the season or something like that, because of the various injury problems. You do think that England are showing signs of everything going wrong at exactly the wrong moment as they approach the World Cup finals. You know, it's because England's first 11 is strong, but the backup's not great, and you really do need like Terry to be in the right frame of mind and Rio Ferdinand to be fit, or else whoever's in goal will be even more exposed than we expect them to be anyway.
Okay, my apologies to Paul Doyle. You were watching Leon Real Madrid at the same time as that Manchester United game would come on. And we'll come back to you to talk about that in part two, which is coming up after this little noise.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with sportingbet.com.
Hi there. Great to have you back and welcome to part two. We'll start with a couple of your posts. On Monday, we were talking about the proposals for a Champions League playoff. Mowgli 84, and slightly long post, I'll rattle through it quickly, but I think he gets the point. The objections to the playoffs, pretty nailed on. The Champions League isn't going to happen. Why? One, UEFA will not have another stick to beat the Premier League with, as it will downgrade the CL with the like of Fulham possibly qualifying. Two, isn't there already a race for fourth place? Three, if it's held over two legs, then the better team usually wins. So what is the point? Liverpool will go through anyway. Four, clubs like Birmingham and Sunderland will be more susceptible to overspending and causing more financial problems in the league. We also had a question from Porkchop Express. Question for the whole pod, he writes. Why is a save penalty referred to as a missed penalty these days? I've always thought of a missed penalty as one that misses the target. If it's on target but gets saved, then I call it a saved penalty. Is that not just because half the penalties that are on target and saved are rubbish?
You're looking at me, and I'm
not because I think you take a rubbish penalty.
I do. I've never forgotten my miss in a school cup final.
That's a lot. That explains a lot. Looking at you today.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe is it just for brevity? I don't know. So and so missed the penalty. Is he? Should so and so had his penalty saved? I have no idea.
It's our blame culture.
I think the post is right, but journalists always want to condemn someone, so the word "miss" leaps into your mind. I think the idea being you're meant to score from the penalty spot, regardless of what the goalkeeper did. Yeah.
So Paul, that Leon Real Madrid game.
Yeah, this was Leon's best performance of the season, and it was the sort of performance that Claude Puel was brought in to produce, because it was reminiscent of what he used to do at Lille. That is very dynamic, pressing high up the pitch, and in doing so, they cut off the supply to Ronaldo and Kaká, who are obviously Real's danger men, and who barely had a touch in the whole game. And then when they got the ball, they passed with precision and speed and unhinged the Real defence regularly. So they've done that very infrequently this season, or indeed last season. And so it's hard to know whether they can reproduce that in the second leg. But certainly it was very encouraging from Leon's point of view, because they've been wobbling a lot in the league recently.
Do you think that's something, a performance they can replicate away from home? Never mind the pressure of playing in the Bernabeu.
Yeah, as I say, because they haven't strung two such performances together under Puel for possibly ever. So you'd say that the odds are probably still in Real's favour. And the central defensive partnership, which has been vulnerable in the league, on Wednesday it was Boomsong and Chris. They performed brilliantly, although they were seldom put under real pressure, but when they were up to it. Can they reproduce that? As I say, they haven't been doing it on a regular basis this season, so it's unlikely. Jean McCoon, who scored the goal, his name was actually booed by the home fans when it was read out beforehand, because he's been in wretched form. But he excelled himself and scored a terrific goal. So it was possibly a one-off. We'll have to wait and see.
Let's go to Spain now to speak to the doctor to get the Spanish side of this affair. The same time as Vampire Weekend appear to be wheeling in their amps into the studio opposite. Sidlo, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you very much. So we've just been talking to Paul Doyle here, getting the French perspective on the Lyon 1-0 Real Madrid match. Give us the Spanish side of things.
Well, the Spanish side, more than anything else, is shock and surprise. They didn't just expect Madrid to win; they expected Madrid to win comfortably. And to some extent, that's the arrogance of you know, knowing that it's Real Madrid and thinking, ah, Olympic Lyonnais, who are they? But also, it wasn't just the Spanish commentators here; it was people who know French football who were saying they didn't think there was really any chance of Lyon winning. And there is a real sense of surprise. And also, as you can probably imagine, there's concern and there's disgust as well, because one of the things about Real Madrid is not just that they're expected to win all the time, but they kind of have to win all the time. When you spend 265 million euros, you know, you put an awful lot of pressure on yourself. The demands are very high, and there's a lot of people pointing the fingers in particular at the Real Madrid coach.
Now, this has been going on since day one, hasn't it? I mean, what's the problem people have with Pellegrini?
The problem people have with Pellegrini, in a way, I mean, in very basic terms, I think, is that he's not Florentino Perez, the president. He's not Ronaldo. He's not Kaká. He is the guy whose head will roll first. Of that, there is no doubt at all. And one of the things that I think that would most concern Manuel Pellegrini is the ease with which the media are going for him. Now, you have to bear in mind the context of this. In particular, we're talking about the daily newspaper Marca. Now, Marca is a newspaper who did more than anyone else to put Florentino back in the presidency at Real Madrid. They got rid of Ramon Calderon, the former president, with a fantastic bit of investigative journalism, it has to be said, and put Florentino in place. They're very, very close to Florentino, and they have been going for Pellegrini from day one. Now, very best case scenario from Pellegrini's point of view is he's got a president who doesn't mind the paper attacking Pellegrini, but does mind them attacking other people. That's the very best case scenario. Very worst case scenario, and one that I think is much closer to the truth, is that they've been given free rein to go for Pellegrini as much as anything else, because if you go for the manager rather than the players, who obviously are the superstars you have to protect because they're part of the whole project, and rather than the president, then you've got someone who can fall by the wayside if things go wrong. Pellegrini is basically expendable at Real Madrid, and the gratuitousness of the way they go for him, I think, displays that, and I think that will concern him more than anything else.
That's absolutely crazy. So you've got a president hiring a manager that he then is going to feed to the wolves after 6 weeks.
Well, he'll feed to the wolves if he has to. I mean, this is the point. And obviously, you know, let's not go too far here. Florentino hasn't got a president, hasn't brought in a manager that he wants to sack. He would much rather that Pellegrini stay. Pellegrini did extremely well, and Pellegrini won everything. But of course, he's got someone who is expendable if needs be. There's another caveat to this which is significant. Florentino Perez didn't want Pellegrini as his coach. He wanted Wenger or he wanted Mourinho. He couldn't get either of them. And Pellegrini was a suggestion of Jorge Valdano, the director general. And I think that as well plays a part in all of this.
Said I was watching the game at the weekend when they ground out a 3-0 win against the bottom club. And teams don't look good in that kind of assignment. It's kind of dull. But you'd never have guessed they'd spent that amount of money in the team. It's as if they still have areas, gaps to fill. I mean, are they really deficient, or do you think it is just bad coaching?
No, I mean, I think this is the problem, is that they have, broadly speaking, not played particularly great football this year. Certainly not the football of a team that spent 260 million euros on players. And in that sense, I think that there are very serious question marks to be made about the way Manuel Pellegrini has set the side up. Collectively, they're not a great team. But bit by bit in recent weeks, it has started to come good. And I think in that sense, this is a real surprise. Not least of course, because the Champions League is an absolute obsession for Real Madrid. You cannot overstate how important this is. The whole season is about the Champions League. La Liga is almost irrelevant because it's not just the Champions League, which is Real Madrid's chance to win the 10th. The thing that measures their ability more than anything else, but also, of course, it's in the Bernabeu at the end of the season. And there's another key fact here. Real Madrid have been knocked out at this stage of the tournament for 5 years running. The bottom line is they're not a big club in Europe, and that's the obsession, going back to being a big club in Europe.
Is there much glee on the Catalan side of the country at the moment?
Well, of course there is, yeah, absolutely, and particularly off the back of the fact that they were beaten at the weekend. Real Madrid really jumped on that and were very gleeful about that. But in truth, I think right now Barcelona, the media and the fans are more concerned about their own problems and their own problems, of course, of that ongoing injury crisis.
Fantastic. All right, Sid, we'll let you go. Great to speak to you. Have a lovely weekend.
I will try. Cheers. Take care.
Cheers, mate. Bye. Okay, there was a fourth game, Champions League, which saw Bayern Munich take a 2-1 lead out of the Allianz Arena against Fiorentina. But it was a highly dubious lead by all accounts. Who wants to chip in and describe to me how offside this winner was?
It was about 3 or 4 yards, but it was so obvious. I think the only possible reason the Lions could have got it wrong was that he thought the contact on the ball came from a defender, because it was a melee of legs and the head of the Bayern Munich striker, whose name escapes me, before it went to closer. But it was so, even live, it's one of those where sometimes with a refereeing howler, you only really appreciate it on a replay, but this was so obvious. It was really, really bad.
Even the winning manager said it was outrageous.
And another argument was video evidence. Yeah. Because the state of the game and the kind of the importance of the error and the fact it was so obvious, it's too, this kind of thing can't go on. And there have been so many recently, as Paul knows full well from the World Cup qualifiers.
It's true.
I
just
I think he's off in some brothel-based reverie now. Yeah,
he's planning.
No,
his
it's just when there's a. I mean, the referee from the France Ireland game was the ref in the Arsenal match last night, and I have no problem with that because I don't think he was actually to blame. He didn't see it. If he didn't see it, he can't give it. But when there is an easily available solution to help officials who don't see things, and
I think it's
a dereliction of duty not to apply it.
I think your point about France Ireland is a good one because a lot of these errors, they look terrible on the replay, but you can't actually... when it's low, I mean, the Palace Villa one was another one when it went off the keeper onto the Palace player and away for a corner. You can't really be certain. Even last night, you couldn't be 100% certain that that ball came off the striker's head rather than the defender's foot. Now, technically, the linesman is supposed to give any benefit of the doubt to the attacker, if there's even a degree of doubt. So therefore, in that sense, it was almost a correct decision. But that's perverse because it was clearly the wrong decision. So I agree. I think you have to look. To not even experiment with video evidence is just ridiculous.
Well, that brings us to the end of all the Champions League action and also to the end of part two. Part three is but a whisker away. Hello, welcome back. We're into part three now. With regard to Wigan Bolton, which sounds like a reasonably dire game on a terrible pitch, but we've got these two teams amongst the I think there's about eight sides within 3 points of the drop zone. Does anybody have any inclinations as to how this is going to shake down at the end?
I do think Sunderland are getting worrying, aren't they? I mean, they managed to draw at Portsmouth, a game they should have won, and it continues a long sequence of underachievement. That kind of negative momentum is really hard to stop.
I think Portsmouth will stay up, personally.
Really?
I just think every time I see them, they look a really decent side.
They're still 8 points.
But
I think their match at the weekend, that would be a huge
They've got a lot of team games. They should basically, I would back them to win against most of the teams in the bottom eight if they played them at home. So if they can win three or four of those games, they can eat into that gap, and they look so much better than the teams around them.
For a bunch of guys who sometimes are owed their wages, and they've got a lot of fights.
It
seems to somehow have
that's
brought them together.
That's embodied by Ohara, who isn't even a Portsmouth player. I think his attitude has been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, but it's even some of these shaky players like Kevin Prince-Boateng and things, people who haven't done well at their previous clubs have come and shown at Portsmouth this year.
And also, I was talking to Paul about this, I don't think Avram Grant gets the credit he deserves. Paul was saying he's made really good tactical changes in a couple of games.
So we've got Saturday, that's the 5:30 kickoff, Portsmouth Stoke City. So we call that a home win, will we?
No, you see, I don't think so. And I think this is why Portsmouth won't stay up, despite the fact that they do play some excellent stuff between the boxes. They struggle to score goals and they miss a lot of chances. And defensively, they tend to make a lot of errors. And last weekend, for example, at Southampton, they were so vulnerable under the high ball to Ricky Lambert. Now, that's something that Stoke will certainly exploit. And Stoke, who have only scored 5 away goals all season, will certainly add to that tally, I imagine, at Fratton Park.
But as you imply, though, Stoke are a very different proposition away from home, aren't they? The contrast is huge.
I bet you're following.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why, though. I don't understand, for example, why Rory Delap's throws that have no effect away from home.
They just don't have
I know it's a narrower pitch at the Britannia, but...
They just don't have as much of the ball, so therefore they don't get into those areas.
Well, they have very little of the ball at home as well.
the only teams that have won in the league are Chelsea and Man U. Oh, and Birmingham. But Birmingham have a very strong defence, but it's away from home is different.
Yeah, so. Portsmouth problems though are not just off the pitch. The problems on the pitch are they continue to grow. Their defence, for example, it's a real pity Matthew Etherington is out from a Stoke point of view because I think Portsmouth are having to play Hayden Mullins at right back at the moment, where he could easily be exposed. Actually, Stoke have problems at right back as well because they will probably play Robert Huth there, which is part of. Poulos often plays 4 centre-backs essentially across the middle. But if Andy Wilkinson were fit, and there's a chance he might be, there's less chance of Belhadj and Quincy exposing that than...
Just a quick note on Stoke, they have this great, as you said, rolling defence, don't they? They have 4 players who can play anywhere across it. Against Man City last week, he changed it 4 different times, partly when Wright Phillips was skinning Wilkinson, so he switched him. I think that's really interesting. If a kind of ostensibly more enlightened manager than Poulos had such an approach, he'd be... hailed for it.
Interesting stuff. I would say that the big game of this weekend is Everton-Manchester United. How do we see that going? I mean, Everton are really bouncing back on a good run of form at the moment.
They had a lot of players injured earlier on this season. I think that's probably the main factor they were so anonymous. But now, of course, they've lost Fellaini, who's exactly the guy you want to have to play against the big boys like Manchester United. But I've got a tremendous regard for David Moyes. I think it's... I don't know if he's had other offers, but staying there for what's now quite a long time, he really has built something. His success rate in the transfer market is very, very good, as it has to be when your budget is limited. I think it's the kind of game you'd expect Everton to take something from, maybe a draw.
Yeah, and we might even see Mikel Arteta.
I think that's another thing. I mean, he's a lovely player and gives you that extra dimension to their play. And they've hardly had him this season, and yet they've still mounted a kind of comeback.
It'll be interesting with Rooney, because if anything is going to derail him, it'll be going back to Everton. Last year, he got booked and was substituted before he got himself sent off. So if it gets feisty, which it frequently does when United play Everton, be interesting to see how the new, supposedly mature Rooney handles it.
Yeah, and will a point be all right for United, you think?
Probably, yeah, because that would still keep them within... Sid always talks in Spain about game swings, a one-game swing or a two-game swing. So if they draw and Chelsea win, it'll be 3 points, a one-game swing. I think they'll probably take that.
Mm-hmm. You think Chelsea haven't been to Old Trafford yet, too? That's another,
exactly.
Another
Chelsea
aspect.
Exactly. Yeah. And it knocks off another hard game, whereas Chelsea have a few other dodgy trips to come.
And then on Sunday, Manchester City host Liverpool. Kevin, hand up straight away.
That's the one where I'm going.
You're looking forward to that?
Yes, I am. I mean, obviously, the Saturday game's interesting. From Monday paper, it's not much good. Right. I'm going to the Man City game. Yes, I mean, because I think Mancini was meant to bring in, cosmopolitan expertise and experience of managing big players, etc., which Mark Hughes didn't really have. But the improvement is hardly visible to the naked eye, is it really? It's
I'd argue they've got worse.
Yeah, well,
well, it's that whole amazing thing where they spend 15 minutes kind of attacking in a Premiership yeah. style and then dropping the defensive line back halfway through in their own half.
I mean, it's not his squad, of course, apart from the odd signing like Patrick Vieira. Yeah. But and therefore he's got that excuse. But I actually thought Mancini may have done a little bit better, but he could easily be on target for the top four, and I guess that's as much as the owners can ask of him.
But does that not give them a big dilemma, though? If he gets them into the Champions League, but in a stuttering fashion, they've got to think... Do we stick or do we twist?
Exactly. It would be an extraordinary thing if he gets them fourth to then sack him. But they won't sack him if he gets fourth. But if they finish fifth, will he go? I mean, even that would be kind of pretty adventurous to get rid of him so quickly. But the way they're playing is very poor. And also he changes both shape and personnel every game in a way that I think is starting to alienate a few fans.
It's a Claudio Ranieri touch, isn't it? That
yeah. Funny enough, the worst thing I think that happened to them, even though he scored a few goals, was Adebayor coming back. Because until then, they had a settled front three of Bellamy, Tevez and Wright Phillips. And since then, they've had to kind of shoehorn Adebayor in, and I don't think it's worked so well.
I mean, he scored that wonderful goal last week, the 40-yard pass, but that's a kind of
a gorgeous goal. But
lovely
in terms
goal,
of the,
yeah.
The
I know, I agree.
Game,
I agree with you, yeah.
And there's still the defensive problems have not been rectified.
No, the defence is a complete joke. But then Campbell will get a game for them.
But if he doesn't buy players in January, he can't really change it much, can he?
Well, that's the other thing. To sack him for underachieving with what isn't his squad would be really harsh.
I mean, it's not what he can do mid-season. Obviously, if Vieira came in, but there wasn't much scope to
back. At the same time, you say this is a big squad. Mm. It's an expensive squad. A good coach would be able to make something out of
it.
Well,
exactly.
Yeah. It's actually that good. Mancini could argue that Hughes bought rubbish. So, for example, Lescott for 20-odd million. The defence isn't good. Is Bridge
good? He's not rubbish.
Enough?
He's overpriced.
Okay, but in terms of, is Lescott a top four player? Is Bridge?
He looked like one last season.
Is Touré now? I'm not sure he is anymore. So I don't know. These are just arguments you might make in favour.
Well, Mancini knew what squad he was going to have to work with when he took the job. And presumably in his interview or whatever, he said, I can make them better.
You don't take a job with a view to only being there 6 months, do you? He would have taken a job with a view to, this squad's okay, I might get them fifth or sixth, then next summer I'll buy.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, one of the candidates who might have been in the frame for Man City and was certainly hovering around like a flightless bird, waiting for a Premiership job, is Guus Hiddink. No, geese can fly. They're not flightless birds. Geese, they migrate they every fly, winter. Yes. Like a flying bird. That's another point well observed. he's buzzed off to Turkey. Now, why do you think he's done that?
Because he doesn't actually want to get back to club football. I think he's been quite clear about that. He likes the more sedate pace of international management.
It's an easy victory as well, isn't it? Turkey are 42nd in the world, two places behind Northern Ireland, and they finished behind Bosnia-Herzegovina, who were second in the World Cup qualifiers, and they were 15 points behind the group winner, Spain. So I think, you know, basically doing anything at all to him, a bit of organisation, will make him look really good. And it's a wonderful place to manage, in a sense. I mean, the passion for the team and the whole culture of Turkish football is brilliant. I don't know how far he can take them, but I mean, what's he got? He's got Tunçay Sanli at Stoke, and the Alton Top twins in the Bundesliga. You know, there's not many stars, but probably enough to do hugely better than his predecessor.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they looked really good at Euro 2008, didn't they?
Yeah,
so,
not long
so
ago.
To see they've fallen that far. Yeah. But it's kind of strange that a man with his talent and who everyone in the world covets would take such an easy life. I know he's kind of in his dotage as a manager, but it still seems slightly strange that he doesn't have fancy one more big club job.
I wonder what he's offered. Were there any rival bids? You know, it's,
there was a lot of talk of Juventus, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, but maybe he thinks, well, this is the offer I've got. Yeah. So,
obviously, a lot of people will know the results by the time they come to listen to the show, but the UEFA Cup was also... The Europa League.
Yeah, come on.
Branding failure.
Come on.
The Europa League.
You're living in the past.
I know. The glory days of the UEFA Cup. That's what I remember.
It's been transformed now. It's called Europa League.
I know. We've had Fulham, Everton, Liverpool, of course, in the Europa League this week. Shakhtar Donetsk arrived. A good Champions League pedigree side, and were immediately subject to a bit of mind games from Mr. Al-Fayed, who some clever member of staff managed to spot them all in their tracksuits and barred them from Harrods. What kind of effect do you think that would have, not being able to get your proper shop in before a game?
Maybe they spent their time, found a metaphorical brothel nearby and said, I don't know, in the name of team bonding.
Team bonding. I mean, do we know that it's all-knowing way the owner knew they were going to come to Harrods and arrange this? I mean,
do you not just think someone behind a counter saw a few tracksuits?
Yeah, I think the truth might be what they said it was. They saw a bunch of guys with tracksuits coming in and didn't like
no football colours. No, I prefer the idea of Al-Fayed having his own intelligence network that goes and works
crafty
on the opponents.
Games.
Yeah,
what's that kind of Goldfinger thing? Watching the cameras in his penthouse suite and saying, ah, there are the players from Shakhtar.
Don't managers print kind of abuse in the press on the dressing room wall? So maybe they'll kind of put a lipstick, one of them slightly nicked, on the dressing room wall to remind them of the insult. I don't know.
All right, very good. That brings us to the close of this week's Football Weekly Edit Extra. Next week, your favourite AC Jimbo will be back, rested from his skiing holiday. He was going to have a phone in with us today, but producer Pete spoke to him and he declined. He declined to be interviewed for the show.
In fact, the low quality of the panel in the studio put him off.
Yeah, well, that must be it. I'd like to say thanks to Rob Smythe, to Kevin McCarroll and Paul Doyle for joining me here today. I'm Paul McInnes and it's been a real pleasure to be with you this week. See you later.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.